Luke chapter 19, verses 1 through 10. He entered Jericho and was passing through. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. And he was seeking to see who Jesus was. But on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried and came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all grumbled. "He has gone in to be the guest of a man who is a sinner." And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated.
Have you ever gone to see someone, but really you hoped they would see you? Have you ever sought after someone, but really you hoped that they might seek after you? I had this experience about 12 years ago. I was on a vacation. Nina and I were on vacation with some of our friends, and they had just had a baby, and these friends are diehard Yankees fans. And we were in Florida. It was spring training. And we went to Legends Field in Tampa, Florida, because we didn't want to just see a Yankees game. We wanted to see Don Mattingly. So here we are at the game. And yes, I did have hair at one point in my life. I had hair when I started working at the chapel. I blame you. So here we are at Legends Field, and they're trying to indoctrinate their child into the cult of the Yankees. And so here we are. Sorry, that was a little harsh there. They're in the front row now. And so we are there. But again, it wasn't just the Yankees. It was Don Mattingly, Donnie Baseball, one of the greatest third basemen of all time. And there is the child and the mom. And they just long for not just to see Don Mattingly, but for Don Mattingly to see them. So I devise a plan. So I got the kid a baseball, and there he's holding the ball. And I decide to write Don Mattingly a note on this baseball. So I get a Sharpie, "Dear Don Mattingly, my friend is here to see you, but they want you to see them. And will you," and I don't know where I came up with this. I said, "Will you bless my baby?" It wasn't my baby, it was my friend's baby. But I wrote, "Will you bless my baby?" And I wrote the section and the seats where we were sitting. So now I just have to get this little note on this baseball to Don Mattingly. So they're guarding the close to the field seats pretty well here. But I found a large family, and I kind of snuck in, you know, as they were going in. I have four kids. I never know who's getting in the van. You want to come on vacation with the Simones, just kind of sneak in, get in the van. We won't notice. So I get in with this family. I sneak in. I'm down in the front row, and this pitcher and catcher are coming down from the bullpen. And I just go, "Hey," and I throw the ball. And your reflexes, they look up, and the ball is coming. And so the ball, the catcher catches the ball. He looks at it, and he goes, "Espanol solamente." I went, "Give it to the other guy." So he gives it to the other guy. I go, "Read the ball." He reads the ball. He takes it to Don Mattingly in the dugout. I can see Don Mattingly is now reading my note. He looks up. He's trying to find the section. He calls like this operations guy. He calls this operations guy over in front of to help him. And the operation guy points out the section. Don Mattingly looks directly at this baby, raises his hand like this, blesses the baby. Now, the blessing worked, because this is the same kid I told you about a couple weeks ago, that he's now playing baseball for the Berkeley Bulldogs. We went to see Don Mattingly, but we were really hoping that Don Mattingly would see us. We were seeking after Don Mattingly, but what if Donnie Baseball would really seek after us? My question this morning is, who do you want to see you? Who is it that you're just hoping will want to see you one day? Maybe it's your spouse, and you think, I'm working so hard, and do they even notice? Maybe it's your children. You're thinking, I'm making so many sacrifices so that my children can grow up and have a good life and understand what love is really about and who God is, and I'm doing all of this. Do they even see me doing it? Maybe you want your grandchildren to see you. I hear often as a young parent from other young parents, their parenting style and the grandparent style, parenting style is just clashing a bit, and they're not quite sure how to bring the grandparents into things, and the grandparents end up feeling like, do my grandkids even get to see me? Is someone keeping them from me? Maybe it's your boss. You just want him or her to say, good job. You want to be seen. Or maybe it's your parents. I hear this a lot, and I heard this most often when I worked in student ministries here at the chapel. It was high school and middle school students that were trying to do the right thing, and they were going, do my mom and dad even notice me, or are they too busy with their thing, their jobs, their friends? I've worked so hard to get into a good school, and did dad even say, I'm proud of you? Who do you want to see you? You see, we go to see people because we want them to see us. We seek after people because deep down we desire to be sought after. But if we're honest, often it feels pretty one-sided, like we're not seen, like we're not sought. But this is not how things work when it comes to Jesus. In our story, we read this. He entered Jericho and was passing through, and behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich, and he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. I must stay. Not I want to stay, not it would please me if I did stay. I must stay. And the literal rendering of the language really grabbed my imagination this week. Literally, Jesus says, it is necessary for me to abide. It is necessary for me to abide with you. Again, not it might be a good idea, or hey, Zacchaeus, if you wanted to, I could come over. There's something necessary about this. I must come. I must abide with you. We are at the sixth Sunday in the season of Lent. And we've been saying each and every Sunday that if you didn't grow up in a church that observed the liturgical tradition of Lent, here's a good definition for Lent. Lent is a season of less in a culture of more. And we tied it into our study this year of call to explore, our call to explore Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and all the way to the end of the earth, that we can often hear that as a call to just add more things to our lives. So our prayer for this Lenten season has been this. This Lenten season, may we hear Jesus' call to explore as a call to alignment before addition. How do we align the everyday aspects of our lives with the mission of God in this world? How do we take the mundane and make sure we use it to bring about God's purposes on this planet? And so we've been looking at the table manners of Jesus. Scenes of table fellowship in the Gospel of Luke. How did Jesus use the most ordinary of all times, happens every day, three times a day, common meals, how did he use those times for God's mission that God gave and entrusted to him? We've been talking about the table manners of Jesus and aligning our table manners with Jesus's table manners. Well, we've been in this study for 6 weeks now, and something unique has happened in this passage in Luke 19, 1 to 10. This is the first time Jesus has invited himself to someone's house. In every other story that we've looked at, Jesus has received an invitation and accepted it. But here, he says, I must stay. I'm coming over whether you like it or not, Zacchaeus. You see, it looks like Zacchaeus is trying to see Jesus. It looks like Zacchaeus is trying to seek Jesus. But the truth is, Jesus is the one who seeks to see Zacchaeus. And so when Jesus is at table with Zacchaeus, he reveals his table manners of seeing, seeking, and saving. This is what Jesus does with Zacchaeus: seeing, seeking, and saving. First, let's look at Jesus seeing Zacchaeus. I'm on page 878 of the Red Bibles, and I'll be right in this story. It's a very familiar story, but if you might be able to see some things for the first time, if you grab the Red Bible in the chair underneath, right in front of you, open up to page 878, Luke chapter 19, verses 1 through 10, and I just want to walk through this passage. Page 878, Luke 19. I'm going to start with verses 1 through 3 here. He, that's Jesus, he entered Jericho and was passing through. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. And he was seeking to see Jesus, who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was small in stature. We learn three things right at the beginning of this story about Zacchaeus. First, he is a chief tax collector. Second, he is rich. And third, the crowd is preventing him from seeing Jesus. Let's take these three things one at a time. Chief tax collector. Now, when you get to this idea of a tax collector, it's not like the IRS. You know, as pleasant as the IRS is, as pleasant as working with them can be, this type of tax collector is much different. You see, God's people lived in occupied land at the time. They had returned from a devastating exile at the hands of the Assyrians and the Babylonians. They had rebuilt their temple and started sacrificing to God, the one true God, again. And then the Romans came in and conquered them again. They didn't destroy the temple, at least not yet. That happens a little later. They didn't destroy the temple. They controlled them through taxation. They said, we are going to tax you, not so that your economy will be destroyed. We are going to tax you so you become so totally dependent on Rome, you won't think about trying to revolt against us. They taxed them at rates of 80%, 85%, sometimes 90%, and said, we are here, we are ready to extort you, and if you rebel, we will come in and crush you. And that's what actually happens in 70 AD. They did rebel and Rome did crush them. But for the time being, someone has to collect these taxes. And Rome needed some people on the ground that spoke the local languages, that knew the people, that understood how the road system worked. How were they going to collect these taxes? And so there were traitors. There were defectors, you might call them, who went against their own people and joined sides with the Roman occupying force and extorted their own people on behalf of Rome. Now this, if that wasn't bad enough, Zacchaeus is called a chief tax collector. This is the only time that this word is used in the entire New Testament, not just in the four Gospels. One time the whole New Testament is someone described as a chief tax collector. It's Zacchaeus. It meant he was the manager. He was the boss man. And there were other little tax collectors underneath him. And he was over a whole territory. And that meant he was in direct contact with Rome, overseeing this whole oppressing operation. Biblical scholar James Edwards puts it like this, what it might have been like to see a tax collector, a chief tax collector like Zacchaeus. There cannot have been many Jews in the first century Palestine who expected or wished to see in a tax collector anything other than the husk of an individual whose soul had been eaten away by complicity with Roman oppression. That's what people saw when they saw Zacchaeus, the husk of an individual whose soul had been eaten away by complicity with Roman oppression. And if that wasn't enough, if he wasn't enough just that he was a tax collector, he's also wealthy. The wealthy have not fared well in Luke's gospel up to this point. Let me just give you a sampling. Luke 6, 24, this is the Sermon on the Plain in Luke. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all people speak well of you, for so their fathers did to the false prophets. Continuing on in Luke's gospel, Luke 12, this is right before Jesus tells what's known as the parable of the rich fool. He says, and he said to them, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And just before the Zacchaeus story, in chapter 18, there's a famous passage, Jesus with a rich young ruler who goes away sad because he had great wealth and was unwilling to surrender that aspect of his life to Jesus. And Jesus says this, Jesus, seeing that he had become sad, said, how difficult it is for those who have wealth to enter the kingdom of God. He's a tax collector, and he's wealthy, and he's earned his wealth on the backs of his own people. So no wonder the crowd is preventing him from seeing Jesus. You see, the passage says that he's prevented from seeing Jesus because of his short stature. But I'll just be honest and say I have some experience with this. You may or may not have noticed, but I'm not tall. Why are you laughing? That's so unkind. Gosh, in church you would laugh. That's Tim Latham. He was one of my pastoral interns. And Evan Muro, he was our college ministry director and small groups director. And that is them graduating from Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. And I had the chance to go and just celebrate with them. And after they graduated, I said, let's take a picture. I regret that picture for the rest of my life. You see, it's not that he can't see Jesus because he's short. I have experience with this. You're at a parade and you're not that tall. You say, excuse me, can I stand in front of you if the person is tall? They say, no problem. Okay, big deal. As long as, you know, my dome is not shining too much and reflecting into their eyes, you know, they're okay. See, short, bald men, it's like the last thing that we're allowed to laugh at in society. So we've all gotten so sensitive. I'm not sensitive. It's okay. I love the roast. It's my favorite form of humor. So you're in a crowd and you wanna see, they're going, fine, sure. Why not? Just stand in front of me. It's not that he can't see Jesus because he's short. The crowd will not let him. He's a tax collector. He's wealthy. And he's gotten his wealth on by extorting his own people. And so verse 4, he's got to climb up into this sycamore tree. Here's a picture of a sycamore tree in the Middle East. It's kind of a low tree with branches that spread out very wide, so you could climb up in it and go out and see over the road. But everything I read about this tree this week was not just that it was a good tree for climbing, it was a good tree for camouflaging. You see, not only does no one want to see Zacchaeus, but Zacchaeus does not want to be seen. He's hiding. He's hiding in this tree. He's trying to get a glimpse, but doesn't want anyone to see him. But in the midst of all of this, Jesus does want to see Zacchaeus. Verse 5, and when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. Note, Jesus calls him by name. He doesn't say, hey, you up there, you who no one wants to be here, yeah, you, let's come and have a conversation. He says, Zacchaeus, come down, hurry, come down. I'm eager to connect with you. You see, Jesus came to see the despised tax collector whose soul had been eaten away by complicity with Roman oppression. who had gained his wealth by extorting his own people. Jesus came to see the man who the crowd had deemed unworthy of being seen. Jesus' table manner of seeing means that Jesus came to see exactly those people who no one else wants to see. Second, seeking. It's not that Jesus just sees him, he also seeks after him. Let me read verses 5-8 again. I'm very taken with verse 5, why I keep repeating it here. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, by name, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. It is necessary for me to abide with you." So he hurried and came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all grumbled, "He has gone to be the guest of a man who is a sinner." And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold." Remember, Zacchaeus was seeking to see Jesus, and it is Jesus who ends up seeing him. Now, in this next section, we see Jesus doing much more than merely seeing Zacchaeus. He seeks to stay at his house. Let me take you back to the first week of our study, Explore the Table, looking at these scenes of table fellowship in the Gospel of Luke. A man named Fred Craddock, who's a well-known preacher and writes a great book on the Gospel of Luke, he said this: in cultures and subcultures of that time and place, table customs were identifying marks of a group, whether philosophical, literary, or religious, as expressed in a Near Eastern proverb, "I saw them eating, and I knew who they were." I saw them eating, and I knew who they were. Remember the literal translation. It is necessary. There is something about Jesus' nature that demands he do this. Something about who Jesus is and what he came to do that makes this not optional, but a requirement. I think the answer of why is found in John 1:16. John writes, "For from his," referring to Jesus, "for from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace." It is the grace of Jesus that demands he seek after Zacchaeus. And let me just take a moment and define grace, because grace is a word that we use in church, but we don't often use it outside of church. And we can kind of think we have the definition and think we understand it, but maybe miss the concept. So I think it's helpful to define grace relative to some other terms that we do use a little more often. So justice. Justice is receiving what you deserve. If you're in a court of law and you are convicted, people, and you have a certain sentence, people say, "Justice was done. The person got what they deserved." Mercy, on the other hand, mercy is receiving less than what you deserve. You say, "The judge was merciful. The judge held back a portion of the sentence because the judge could see the remorse of the person, or there were mitigating circumstances regarding the crime. So the person receives mercy. They get less than what they deserve." But grace is wholly different. Grace is receiving a gift you do not deserve. It's not getting what you deserve. It's not receiving less than what you deserve. It's receiving something entirely that you do not deserve at all. Jesus is giving the despised Zacchaeus a gift. It's the gift of friendship. It's a gift of friendship that he does not deserve, that you can see no one else in the story is willing to give him. And in response, Zacchaeus' life is changed. But I want us to note the order here, the order of the friendship and the response. You might call this the order of grace. If you're taking notes, write down that little phrase, the order of grace. What's the order of grace? Notice it is not that Zacchaeus changes his life and so receives Jesus' friendship. No, he receives Jesus' friendship, and therefore he changes his life. And I want us to see how dramatically Zacchaeus' life is changed. It's changed personally. Zacchaeus is acting very differently here at the end of the story than the description that you got at the beginning. It's changed personally. His household has changed. Jesus says, I say unto you, salvation has come to this house. The whole house is affected by Zacchaeus's transformation. So it's not just personal, it's domestic. It's not just personal and domestic. Zacchaeus says, I'm gonna give half of what I own to the poor right now. It's not just personal and domestic, it's social. The poor in that community are gonna benefit from Zacchaeus's friendship with Jesus. And it's not just personal and domestic and social, it's also economic. Zacchaeus says, if I've defrauded anyone fourfold, or if I've defrauded anyone anything, I will pay them back fourfold. In Numbers chapter 5, you learn that in the law of Moses, if you defrauded someone of something, if you stole from someone and it was found out, you owed them what you stole plus 20%. That was the law of Moses, plus a fifth. Zacchaeus' friendship with Jesus changes him personally, domestically, socially, and so much economically. He says, I'm not doing 20%, I'm doing 400%. His whole life is transformed, not because he changed his life and then Jesus said, now you're worthy of my friendship, but because Jesus said, I'm going to offer you my friendship, and Zacchaeus is so moved by that, then he changes his life. Again, biblical scholar James Edwards talks about this grace of Jesus shown with Zacchaeus. He puts it like this. Grace is forever scandalous because it is forever undeserved. It is doubly scandalous for Zacchaeus, a rich oppressor who seems so much less deserving of grace than Lazarus, a wretched outcast. There's a story about him back in chapter 16. Grace is a scandal because it insists on including those whom we wish to exclude. The story of Zacchaeus illustrates such grace. It ends not with Zacchaeus seeking Jesus, but with Jesus seeking him. And this scandal is why the crowd is grumbling. Look at verse 7 of our passage. And when they saw it, that's the crowd, they all grumbled. Not some of them were upset by this. Not some of them said, you know, that's a little extreme. I'm not sure I like this Jesus guy anymore. No, they all grumbled. They're all upset. It's like an NFL referee. They just want to go, flag, flag on the play. No, Jesus, this is not possible. You are not going to do this. You don't know what he's done to this community. Up until now in Luke's gospel, who's been grumbling the most? And maybe you've picked up on this as we've done this series on Explore the Table. Who's been grumbling in Luke's gospel? The Pharisees. Yeah, I heard it over here. The Pharisees have been grumbling. They see who Jesus is eating with and they don't like it and they grumble. And when it comes to Zacchaeus, guess who's grumbling now? Everyone. They're all doing it. They can't believe it. It's too much of a scandal. And so I hope this is good news for all of us this morning. For all of us who live our lives with the guilt and shame, knowing we have done things we should not have done and not done things that we should have done. All of us who live just hoping that there's this something that we just hope no one will ever find out about us. Jesus has good news. He's seeking you. He's seeking me. He's saying, I must come to your house. Not I want to come to your house. He's saying, I must come. He's offering grace upon grace. And we can receive it now by placing our ultimate faith and trust in him. Hear me on this. Your life will change from there. I see too many people make this mistake. They try to change their life and say, I'm gonna change my life and then I'll ask Jesus to be Lord of my life. It doesn't work that way. That's not the order of grace. Place your faith and trust in Jesus right now. Your life will change from there. Try to change your own life and you'll wait forever. Anyone who has any amount of life experience knows that we don't have the power to change our lives on our own. Jesus' table manner of seeking means that he is seeking those whom the crowd is unwilling to seek. He's seeking you. He's seeking me this morning. Each week, we've been asking questions to help us apply Jesus's table manners to our table manners. And so my question this morning for us all is, do I have eyes to see and a heart to seek? Do I have eyes to see those that the world is saying, don't look at that? They're not worthy of being seen. And do I have a heart to seek and to go after the least and the last and the lost in this world? I have a wonderful set of in-laws. And Nina's maiden name is Strickland. So it doesn't sound very ethnic, but that doesn't quite get at some of the ethnic things I deal with in my relationship with my in-laws. You see, her mom's maiden name is Dominici. As I've said, she's Puerto Rican, and I've learned a lot about Puerto Rican culture. I've learned a lot about what it means to do that dance with your in-laws in our 15 years of marriage. And so one of the things that I've learned is that Puerto Ricans, they just show up. They don't ask. They don't say, hey, would you like? They just come. And this often happens on birthdays, so much so that we created a name for it, me and the other son-in-law, we have to sort of bond together and sort of help each other understand what it is we're experiencing here. We call it the birthday train. We say the birthday train always rides, no matter what. You can be turning 33, not a milestone birthday, you know, not any big deal. You could be turning, you know, 47, 51, 63. It doesn't matter. The birthday train will ride. And we even have a little sound when they show up. We go, doot, 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 doot. The birthday train will ride. I remember one time, Nina's brother, there was some kind of party, and he was living in Charlottesville, her older brother, and he had specifically requested that no one come. He actually said, please do not come to this party. And it then started to snow, and I-64, they're like about to shut down I-64, and somehow I find myself in a van with Nina and my in-laws. We're going 35 miles an hour down I-64. There's snow everywhere, and we show up at this party, and her brother says, I told you not to come. Dude, the birthday train will ride. And here's what I've learned from the birthday train. It is always a good idea to show up. I laugh about it sometimes, but I'm always grateful. Always grateful to see them. I'm always going, okay, 38, you still want to celebrate me. It's always a good idea to show up. Do you have eyes to see and a heart to seek? Or are you waiting for your neighbor to come over and say, I'd really like you to come over, I'm kind of lonely. Are you waiting for your neighbor to say, you know, I've been sick and would you come talk to me about it? No, get on the train and ride. Do you have eyes to see and a heart to seek? It's always a good idea to show up. As Jesus sees others, we should see others. As Jesus seeks after others, we should seek after others. But remember, Jesus's table manners in this story are not just seeing and seeking. They're seeing, seeking, and saving. Because we see here in verse 9 of the story, Jesus says to Zacchaeus, today salvation has come to this house. Salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Jesus declares that his mission was to seek and save the lost. I'm here to seek after all of the lost sons and daughters of this world, all of the Zacchaeuses of the world, all of us whose souls have been eaten away with complicity to our own pride and our own desire to be Lord of our own lives. I want you to take note of the geography of this story. And this is what makes this a great passage for Palm Sunday. Look at the first verse of the story. He entered Jericho and was passing through. Now, we know since Luke chapter 9, verse 51, Jesus has set his face toward Jerusalem. It's his ultimate goal. It's his ultimate destination. And on the left there, you can see way up at the top in Capernaum is where he started. And he's made his way slowly down, and he's gotten to Jericho. And then I blew up the map there on the right. There's Jericho, and what comes next? Jerusalem. Jericho is the final stop for Jesus before he arrives in Jerusalem. He actually meets with Zacchaeus. He tells a story. And in verse 28 of chapter 19, it says, and when he had said these things, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. You see, in Jericho, Zacchaeus climbed a tree seeking to see Jesus. And in Jerusalem, Jesus climbs a much taller tree. Jesus climbs the ultimate tree. He climbs up on the cross. And he takes not just the oppression of Rome onto himself, he takes all of the oppression of the world, all of the sin, all of the death as he climbed up his tree because he was seeking to save us. We read these words in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 3. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. You see, the crowd in Luke 19 thinks that Zacchaeus is the despised man, and Jesus ultimately becomes the despised man that the crowd did not merely grumble about, but that the crowd spit upon and thrust a crown of thorns on his head and said, you saved others like Zacchaeus. Save yourself. At a table with the despised is not a description of Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is at the table with the one who would become ultimately despised so that we could be totally and fully welcomed in Jesus Christ. You see, Donnie Baseball offered a moment of his time, a moment of his time to look up and to never think of us again. Jesus offered his very life because God's holiness demanded it and God's grace upon grace required it. There was no other way to make I must stay at your house possible, not just for Zacchaeus, but for all who long for the day of salvation, all who long to be seen, to be sought, to be saved by their Creator. The women in Open Door Bible Study are studying a book called 40 Days of Decrease by a woman named Alicia Britt Cole, and I'll close with a quote from their study about Jesus' time in Gethsemane. He did not want to be that alone. Jesus requested the disciples' companionship. Their alert presence could have been a comfort to him. We know that Jesus' presence is valuable to us, but we rarely consider the possibility that our presence is valuable to him. Today, reflect upon this concept of Jesus treasuring your companionship. As we come to the table, to his table, reflect that Jesus treasures your companionship so much, he sees you, he seeks after you, and he climbed up a tree to save you.